The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Romany Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Vogue Magazine, Rookie Magazine, and from American Originality by Louise Gluck. That's a collection of essays by Louise Gluck, a favorite writer of mine. The theme for today is revenge, and the first story is from that book of essays, again called American Originality, and this essay is titled On Revenge. When I was a child, I was enormously sensitive to slights. My definition of slights was as broad as my sensitivity was deep. I trust my memory on this point because the child I describe corresponds so exactly to the evolved adult. I was also, then as now, rigidly proud, unwilling to show hurt or admit need. Pride governed my behavior. It precluded to my mind all show of anger, which seemed obviously retaliatory by confirming the slight or wound. It gave satisfaction, I thought, to the tormentor. Anger was the show of blood that proved the arrow had penetrated. Moral or ethical anger of the kind provoked by concentration camps was exempt from these inhibitions. But most such focuses, like the camps, aroused terror rather than rage. I had, if I can judge by my vast catalogue of slights and my icily theatrical self-protective disdain, a vast suppressed rage. It is hardly surprising that my fantasy life consisted mainly of dreams of triumphant ascendance. None of these fantasies involved action. My revenge fantasies were founded on contempt for action, for any show of effort. Damage occurred without my apparent agency and perpetuated itself indefinitely. To need to wound, or, as in the books I read, murder the enemy, was to display the insufficiency of self, just as action proved the existence of hurt. My idea of revenge was to prove that I had not been hurt, or had somehow exacted hurt, which, as my fantasies repeatedly demonstrated, I had miraculously transformed into something intensely to be envied. My dream was to create envy. My idea of revenge depended on the object's remaining conscious and fully aware. Mainly I thought about the poems I would write. In my imagination, these poems would be of a greatness that compelled, in throngs of readers, a uniform amazement, the only disagreements arising out of attempts to describe this greatness or account for it. At some point, I became aware that such response had never, in the history of literature, occurred. But I continued to feel it would occur, it had to occur, because my own response to the literature I revered was so intense, so absolute. I was, in such moments, suffused with awe, which seemed to me utterly different from opinion, the latter garrulous, the former dumbstruck. I felt myself in the presence of an incontestable truth or universal law. Curiously, I was not annihilated by this awe as I expected the enemies in my fantasies to be. In them, awe would combine with feelings of horrified shame, an awareness of wrongs that could never be made right, a sense of their own lacks and misjudgments. My revenge fantasies equipped my adversaries with sophisticated and discerning literary taste. They punished themselves while I simply and transcendently existed. This scenario was always to some degree present in my imaginative life. It became my immediate response to all public and private failure, to scorn, to betrayal, but also to much smaller events and embarrassments to which such fantasies were wildly disproportionate. But they were not simply balm. They were also fuel. They fed an existing desire to write poetry, transforming that desire into urgent ambition. They could not replace inspiration or bribe it into existence, but they augmented inspiration with a driving sense of purpose or necessity. They animated me when I might easily have been paralyzed. It was for many years intensely pleasurable to anticipate the leisurely unfolding over time of revenge, with its just and glorious reversals of existing judgments and power relations. Crucial to these fantasies was a premise of spacious or expansive time, in which the distance from the humiliated present self to the triumphant innate self could be bridged. The language of revenge depends wholly on the future tense, they'll see, they'll be sorry, and so on. Because time always seemed to me imperiled, or in short supply, I did not expect age to influence what, in my fantasy life, must have been a theoretical attitude, and yet something has changed. The fantasies have vanished, and with them the tremendous surges of energy and stamina. Something about actually attaining those ages at which, in every possible sense, time is likely to be short, or certainly rapidly diminishing, seems different from feeling constantly that one would be cut off unfairly or prematurely. In addition to that sense of expansive time, my fantasies required that my adversaries remain immutable, stable, frozen in my infinite future. The person soon to be devastated by my virtuosity and spiritual depth must be identical to the person who held an object about to be thrown at me. But my rivals and judges, like my friends and colleagues, have all been chastened and battered by time. Pity and fellow feeling have weakened vengefulness, or replaced it with a sense of collective, as opposed to hierarchical, experience, substituting an unexpected mildness and generosity for my earlier sternness and violence. These shifts have made the fixation on new targets a far less vigorous act, briefly rancorous, but capable of generating no real energy. I sometimes miss them, those immutable enemies and the power they conferred, as well as a myth of generous time on which the little raft of self seemed likely to be supported for many decades. But my fascination now with this subject is more pragmatic and anxious, how to supply those energies that were, all my life, fed by the passion for revenge. Okay, this next revenge story is called On Taking Yourself Seriously, from Rookie Magazine, and it's by Sadie Doyle. Friends, gather round now. I'm going to tell you a story about the value of taking yourself seriously. When I was in seventh grade, I had the worst health teacher in the entire world. I find it important at this juncture to tell you his actual name, which was Mr. Dusenberry, because here is the truth about Mr. Dusenberry. He was mean and sexist, and during every single class, he would launch into a tirade about how women were worse than men. There's a footnote here, and the footnote says, as you might imagine, when we fact-checked this article with Mr. Dusenberry, he disputed a lot of what I say in this article, but I stand by my memory. We were smaller, we were weaker, we had terrible hormones that made us crazy, and we would never be able to compete with men professionally because we were all going to get pregnant and stop working to raise our babies, which was what nature intended us to do, and. I tried to fight him on it, but he would just tell me to do some one-armed push-ups then if I was so equal to men. He could do one-armed push-ups, could I? So I just started tuning him out. I don't recommend this strategy generally. I believe you should always pay attention, in every class, unless paying attention means dealing with one more second of Mr. Dusenberry. And in my case, it did. So I would show up for the part where he told me how intestines worked, and when the ladies, actually terrible at having intestines, portion began, I would start writing in my notebook or reading a novel. When Mr. Dusenberry caught me, he took the book I was reading, held it up in front of the class, and ripped it in half. I told him he had no right to do that. He did the one-armed push-up speech. I told him that maybe he should have spent some time learning to teach instead of perfecting his one-armed push-up skills. And he sent me to the principal. The principal asked me why I had this terrible habit of writing instead of listening to misogynist rants, and I told him that I wrote because I was going to be a writer in New York, and I was probably specifically going to write about how sexism was wrong. And he said this, "The thing is, that's just extremely unlikely to happen. And you're going to have a really hard life if you just decide not to listen to people that you personally feel are sexist." "When it happens," I said, "I'll send you the story about Mr. Dusenberry." Which, what a ridiculous thing for a 14-year-old to say. So immature, so grandiose, such a typical adolescent fantasy. I am sure my principal laughed himself to sleep that night. "Yes, yes, you're going to become a writer and tell everyone how awful this school was, and then we'll be sorry. Good luck, little girl. I'm quaking in my sensible shoes right now." Dear Mr. Dusenberry and the principal, my mother will be mailing the school a printed copy of this article, along with my CV and a list of the awards and recognition I have won for A, writing, and B, writing specifically about sexism, and C, not listening to sexist authorities when I wrote about sexism. I will be happy to accept either your signed apology or the school's apology on your behalf. You may then... I'm sorry, one second, I've lost my place. You may also consider consider making me a big festive banner reading, "Okay, you win." Although, should you wish to send this victory banner to me directly, you will need to ask my mother for my precise address, because it is in New York City, that's why. There is a point to all this, besides the fact that no competent professional would ever hire someone like Mr. Dusenberry and put him alone in a room with small children. The point is that, for anyone, but especially for girls, it can be very hard to hold on to your ambition. Even now, when it's pretty much taken for granted that most girls will grow up to have jobs, girls are still discouraged from taking their desires for accomplishment too seriously. Because accomplishment is hard, and accomplishment on some basic level is pretty selfish. To really devote yourself to achieving something, anything, becoming a writer, becoming a lawyer, becoming the world's best mini golf player, you have to have a vision of what you want, and you have to want it fiercely, and you have to be able to throw your whole weight behind getting it. But girls aren't supposed to care that much about what they want for themselves. Like my awful, awful health teacher used to say, we're supposed to put our own ambitions aside and focus on other people. And those other people don't even have to be babies. Consider the difference between a guy who stays in every weekend to practice guitar and a girl who does the same thing. The guy is a brooding, intense, passionate musician. The girl is just unpopular. That's all a load of crap. Ambition is great. Wanting things is great. Being willing to work hard to get what you want, being willing to make sacrifices in order to fulfill your own dreams, that is all super great and admirable, and you are going to need it. Because here's the thing, your ambitions and desires for accomplishment are what allow you to have a sense of self. If you don't have a sense of what you want from life, it's easy to just define yourself around other people and to do whatever they seem to want from you. And other people can take away their approval at any time. But when you provide your own approval, when you know what you want and know you have what it takes to get it, you have a basis for feeling good about yourself that doesn't go away. Right now, you are in one of the world's most enviable positions. You're a teenager. What that means is that you're smart enough and mature enough to start thinking about what you want to do with your life. But you're also young enough to consider many different possibilities. You don't have to commit to anything on a permanent level right now. Everything is about exploration. But while you're exploring, it's a really good idea to get in touch with what makes you the happiest. Take a look at everything you really enjoy doing, and every future you sometimes like to think you'll have. Try to envision yourself actually occupying those futures. Ask yourself what would fulfill you about each one. Or what fulfills you the most, right now. Which hobby or action or mode of operation gives you something that nothing else can. It doesn't have to be a big, grand, noble answer. I didn't decide I wanted to be a writer and to write about sexism because I wanted to, capital C, change the world. I decided that I wanted to write about sexism because I was shy and weird and wanted to find a way to communicate with people, a way to show them how I saw the world. And one of the ways I felt most misunderstood was around being female. I didn't line up easily with what people expected girls to do or be. So I figured unpacking the world's expectations about being a girl might be a good place to start. It was a good start, but it was also something that other people could use. And that's the way it is for most people. If you examine your own needs, you're going to find that somewhere, somehow, somebody else needs you to fulfill them. Do you personally need to help people who are hurting? Good. The world needs therapists, doctors, and human rights advocates. Do you need to explore, to figure out something new about how the world works? Good. The world needs scientists and investigative journalists. We still don't totally know what's at the bottom of the ocean. You can find out what the bloop was, and then I can sleep at night. Unless it was actually a sea monster. Please, God, tell me it's not actually a sea monster. Do you need attention? Yeah, well, so did I, and the world needs loudmouths in every single creative field. Do you need to prove yourself through competition? Good. Find a place where you can compete and start winning. If I ever need a lawyer, I may end up calling you. I recommend that you start here, with what you want, because the rest of it is pretty hard and requires a lot of strategy. Once you've figured out what you want, you'll have to figure out what you need, and that can be a good deal more complicated. Fantasies are good, and so are goals, but to move forward, you're going to actually need a plan. The first step is actually not that hard. To realize a dream, you only have to break it down into its most basic components. To be a writer, you need A, the ability to write, B, somewhere to publish your writing, and C, people to read it. Here you go. You're a writer now. To become an activist, you need A, a cause to rally your community around, B, a community to rally with, and C, a way to communicate your concerns to the public. and especially to people with the power to change whatever you're concerned about. Start talking to people. Find out what they think the problems are with your school or with the world, and start figuring out how you can ally with them to make an impact. Simple. Other ambitions are more complex and harder to realize. To become a therapist or a scientist or a lawyer, you need many years of specialized training. To become an athlete, you need a lot of physical conditioning and often a team to join. But still, in order to do any of those things, you need to break them down to basics. What are the core resources that you need to do this job? What can't you ignore or skip if you're going to do this right? And where can you locate those resources? Answering those questions is your first step. The second step is actually locating the resources. This is key. It doesn't take much to be a published writer, but to be a good writer, you actually will need some training, people to give you feedback and guidance. It's pretty simple to be an activist, but to be a good one, you have to be able to educate yourself on the issues and understand which tactics work or don't. But this is where the whole girls are supposed to make people like them thing actually comes in handy. The simplest and easiest way to locate resources, to be directed toward the sorts of education or training you need, or to learn about a field, is to ask people. Somewhere, someone is doing what you want to be doing. You need to talk to that person. Obviously, in the age of internet, it's pretty easy to find people with your dream job. But it's usually better to start with the people in your own community. If you want to be a musician, for example, you don't necessarily want to send a letter to every musician on your iPod. Dear Kanye West, please teach me how to produce records. Love, your name here. Even if Kanye does write back, you're going to get a pretty weird answer. And people who get a lot of attention are far less likely to respond personally or at all to attention from people they don't know. It's a volume thing. When you get 5 emails a day, you can respond to all of them. But when you get 50 or 500, you might not even have time to read them. You're better off looking for local musicians and producers whose work you admire. People who are nearby and accessible, and far more likely to appreciate a girl who wants to listen to them talk about how they make their art and how they learn to make it. Oh, and by the way, try to actually admire their work. They can tell if you don't, and it makes them a lot less friendly. Ideally, you'll find someone who can really guide you through the field and promote you within it. A good, close, one-on-one relationship. A mentor. This is the part that every career guide for girls stresses. Find a mentor, love your mentor, learn from your mentor. But the fact is, if you don't find one, it isn't the end of the world. I, for example, never had one special mentor. I've had about 15 mentors. My friend who ran a feminist blog full-time taught me how to make a sustainable wage from blogging and told me about the importance of reader donations and where to find feminist-friendly ad support. My friend who has extensive experience in political reporting taught me how to report a story responsibly and gave me reporting assignments when I'd had very few of them so that I could learn under her guidance. Even now, when I have a tricky question about a piece, I go to her. My friend who writes a lot about how the internet works and how it relates to the publishing industry told me how to transition from blogging to writing for other people and introduced me to other people who knew a lot about it. All of these people were mentors. And that's why it's important for you to have done the breakdown. There are about 1,000 things you need to know in order to really pursue your ambitions, and there are about 1,000 people who can teach you. Your job is to keep your eyes open, to notice the gifts in the people around you, what they're great at, and learn how they got to be so great. Because here's the thing, while you're looking around for people who share your passions and noticing what makes them great, you're going to discover a few other things. You're going to discover what you are great at, what makes you unique, and what you can contribute that no one else can. And that's how you find out who you are and what gives you the basis to care about yourself and your ambitions. You also discover that pursuing your ambitions doesn't have to be lonely. You don't just find yourself when you take yourself seriously. You find your community, and that can be the greatest feeling in the world. Well, second greatest, because here's the other thing. Your personal Mr. Dusenberries, the people who told you that you couldn't, you can't, you won't, you have to settle. If you really go for this, take yourself seriously enough to put your whole weight behind what you want, you are going to be able to prove them wrong. Not just say they're wrong, not just think they're wrong. Get the proof and know that they were wrong. It might take a while, but it can happen, and it probably will. And even 15 years later, that feels pretty awesome. So that was more a story about ambition and following your dreams than revenge. But I like the little sort of revenge part in the beginning where she gets to stick it to her teacher who never believed in her. But I figured in order to balance this out a little bit, I should include an article that shows maybe the negative side of revenge or feelings of revenge. And this is from Psychology Today. It's called Revenge. Will you feel better? Understanding how emotions and thoughts influence behavior is important for people who have intense emotions and are often ruled by them. Knowledge about emotions and the thoughts that strengthen or soften those emotions can help people develop ways to better manage their actions. One urge that people experience but rarely discuss is revenge. Webster's Online Dictionary defines revenge as to avenge, usually by retaliating in kind or degree or to inflict injury in return for something, such as to revenge an insult. Revenge seems to be one of the deepest instincts we have. Who hasn't said, "I hope he gets his," or wished that karma would strike sooner rather than later? Dirty Harry's "Go ahead, make my day" resonates across generations. Out-of-control revenge, attack and counterattack can be blinding and destroy the lives of all involved, but our instincts and emotions usually serve a purpose. Researchers and theorists believe that revenge is a form of establishing justice, and that the threat of revenge may serve as a form of protection, a kind of enforcement of social cooperation. Imagine that your neighbor hosts large overnight parties and his guests continually park so that you can't get out of your driveway. If you believe that your neighbor is a rational person who won't retaliate, you may be tempted to key the guests' cars or smear them with eggs. If you think your neighbor would come after you, then you are less likely to act on your anger. Maybe the purpose of revenge is in preventing certain hostile actions, or the threat of revenge ensures people do not hurt you in the future. But sometimes people act revengeful when no good can come of their actions other than to inflict suffering on others. Those actions can go to unfathomable extremes, from lovers running over a beloved iPhone or destroying what their ex most values, to businessmen damaging the careers of those who have rejected them, to students opening fire in school hallways. Revenge can be an act of anger, hurt, and power. People who have been hurt or betrayed seem to believe without any doubt that if the other party suffers, then they will feel better. Their emotional pain will lessen. Is this true? Revenge makes you feel worse. To test whether revenge makes people feel better, Kevin Carl Smith and his colleagues set up a group investment game with college students where if everyone cooperated, everyone would benefit equally. However, if someone refused to invest his or her money, that person would benefit at the group's expense. A secret experimenter, called a free rider in each group, convinced the group members to invest equally. But when it came time to put up the money, the free riders didn't go along with the agreed-upon plan. As a result, the free riders earned an average of $5.59, while the other players earned around $2.51. Here's the revenge part. Carl Smith offered some groups a way to get back at the free rider. They could spend some of their own earnings to financially punish the group's defector. Everyone who was given the chance for revenge took it, and they predicted that they would feel much better after they got their revenge. The results showed that the students who got revenge reported feeling worse than those who didn't, but believed that they would have felt worse if they hadn't gotten back at the free riders. The students who didn't get the opportunity for revenge said that they thought they would feel better if they'd had that opportunity, even though the survey results identified them as the happier group. Both groups thought revenge would be sweet, but their own reported feelings showed that revenge made them less happy. How to explain this? Carl Smith suggests that the reason revenge increases anger rather than decreasing it is because of ruminations. When people don't get revenge, they tend to trivialize the event by telling themselves that because they didn't act on their vengeful feelings, it wasn't a big deal. Then it's easier to forget it and move on. But when people do get revenge, they can no longer trivialize the situation. Instead, they go over and over it and feel worse. After considering the studies that found revenge wasn't so sweet for the avenger, Mario Gollwitzer still thought that there were some situations in which revenge could be satisfying. He considered two possibilities. One was that revenge alone wasn't enough for the avenger to have satisfaction. The offender must know the connection between the original insult and the retaliation. He called that the understanding hypothesis. The second possibility was that of comparative suffering. This meant that seeing an offender suffer was important. His research results showed that the only situation when acting on revenge was more satisfying than not acting on revenge was when the offender understood and acknowledged why the act of revenge had occurred. He described this understanding hypothesis as reestablishing justice. The problem, according to Eric Jaffe, is that while the avenger often believes the offender received just deserts, the offender usually perceives the retaliation as too harsh. Thus, an endless cycle could follow. Most people understand this concept, so why do people continue to believe in and have such strong urges for revenge? Is revenge hardwired? Dan Ariely discusses revenge experiments in which the participants' brains were scanned by positron emission tomography, PET, while they were making decisions about revenge. The results showed increased activity in the reward center of the brain, striatum. The greater the activation, the more the participants punished the offenders. Ariely suggests that this punishing betrayal or perceived betrayal has a biological basis and feels pleasurable. At least the decision to get revenge does. Ariely states that revenge and trust are opposite sides of the same coin. Perhaps the idea that people believe revenge restores justice is really about reestablishing trust. Ariely's experiments on revenge showed that the tendency to seek revenge did not depend on whether the actual person responsible for the offense suffered, but only that someone associated with the offense pay. Time passing helped lower the urge for revenge for small annoyances. In addition, apologies completely counteracted the effect of small annoyances. When an apology was given, the participants did not extract revenge. Please note, this was a one-time annoyance, not a series of repeated offenses. What to do when you have thoughts of revenge? I'm going to summarize this because we're almost out of time. So first is being mindful of what you're experiencing. Then accept your urges and thoughts of revenge as a basic human response related to trust. Then, remember, while the anticipation of revenge may feel pleasurable, the actual carrying out of revenge brings little satisfaction and may create more problems than suffering. Then, wait until you are calm emotionally and can think rationally before making any decisions. Then, consider whether the loss of trust is justified. Do you have all the facts? Maybe there's been a misunderstanding, a miscommunication, or maybe there is a problem that could be solved. Learn from the experience, focus on what is in your control, and take the next right step. And finally, practice radical acceptance that some people will break your trust. That is a statement about them, not about you. Your response is about you. Okay, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.